What are we doing when we practice? What are we actually doing? In good moments, in good days, when things are pleasant, we may have the thought that we're dedicating our entire lives to the Dharma by practicing. We may have a sense of inspiration and this sense of doing something really good. In other times, bad days or unpleasant moments, we may think that we're totally crazy to be practicing. In actuality, when we practice, we're doing nothing. This is what I want to talk about tonight. Another word, or another way of putting this, is that of sacred idleness. I want to speak about sacred idleness tonight. A Zen master was once asked, "Why do you practice? What do you do when you practice?" And he responded by saying, "Nothing. I practice for no reason, and I'm doing nothing when I practice." And yet, if you observed this Zen master, you would notice that he was devoting his entire life to it. So what is this nothingness that asks for all of our life? Huh? What it is a non-reliance on the usual objects and objectives in life to bring lasting fulfillment. We begin to see through their seeming reliability into the fact that they're not as reliable as they appear to be. Sitting is the most visible expression of this. When we sit, we express this. Dogen said, "Sitting is the practice of the reality of life. Sitting is non-activity. This is the true form of the self. Outside of this, there is nowhere to search for the truth." So you could say that whether pleasant or unpleasant, good days or bad, mundane times, ordinary times, we sit just to sit. In actuality, we sit because it's real. No, it's not something that we're making up or creating or concocting. It's not an illusion. In the sitting, over and over again, what we're doing is letting go of agendas, letting go of trying to get somewhere or to get something, to be able to reside in who we really are. When we sit, we question the cultural values of needing this and needing that, having to accumulate in order to know lasting happiness. Questioning the happiness of being famous or having a particular status in life or looking a particular way, the whole emphasis on appearance in the culture. We begin to question this deeply within ourselves when we just sit with our eyes closed, attempting to simply be present and to settle more into reality. We also sit letting go of the tendency to compare ourselves with others. Out of the tendency to compare ourselves with others, we tend to compete with others. And we miss the fact that we are completely one. So we fall into an illusion of separateness when we don't question in this way. Sitting is a non-reactivity in the body. Now you can sit, I can sit, we can sit, and yes, the mind is going all over the place, the emotions are here and there, the body is aching perhaps, and yet there's a physical non-reactivity to that, because one is not moving in reaction to what is happening. So it's a great way to educate or to teach the mind not to move as well, just the physicality of the sitting. As well, in the sitting, we're not leaning. We're not leaning. We're learning that happiness comes from within by not leaning towards particular objects or objectives, but instead letting go of the extra. This is what sitting is. It's letting go of the extra. Some of you know the story of the Buddha touching the ground on the evening that he was awakened. And we had this time of being challenged, supposedly by external forces, but probably by internal forces much more. And so he touched the ground at a certain point as a statement of commitment that I deserve to sit here. I deserve to awaken. I deserve to be here and to know my true self. This is the same thing that each one of us is doing when we sit. We're touching the ground and we're understanding the value of doing nothing. In a way, you could say that every time we sit, we're putting our body behind our aspirations. It's so easy to dream about awakening, or to think about these things, or to imagine it sometime in the future, or to get down on ourselves because we're not quite awakened enough, or to obsess about this or about that. But to actually sit is a way of saying, I really believe in this. Now, there's enormous trust in ourselves every time we put ourselves into a still position and just stay there. Because again, it's putting our body behind our yearnings. Instead of just thinking about it and it being a wonderful thought, but maybe for someone else, not for us, we're closing that gap through the commitment to the sitting. It's very powerful. We can allow this to support us. We can remember this every single time that we sit, that we choose it. Sometimes on retreats, one has to remind people, because it's so sometimes difficult to be there, that it actually from moment to moment is a choice to be there. It's a choice that one is making. And every single time we move into a still posture, we're making that same choice. Out of that comes a great deal of trust and of faith. Rodney was mentioning that we haven't seen the mountains since I've been here. And I know they're there. I trust Rodney and Ellen, and I know that they're there, but I haven't seen them at all. So much so that we had to go to a bookstore so that they could show me a postcard of Seattle with a mountain hanging over it. And, you know, I believed it before that, but it was certainly helpful to see it. And so knowing this, having some kind of trust or faith, because if we have a body and a mind, and we continue to devote our lives to this, we do see our own true nature on our own. Even if there is doubt, as there is likely to be, it's somewhat inevitable until there isn't. Even if there is doubt, there is still trust by committing oneself to the practice. Just again, every time we're willing to be still, we're willing to not move, we're committing ourselves to the practice. It's a way of getting behind ourselves and closing that gap between the rumors and what we can actually experience for ourselves. You know, the gap that can so easily be there between what we read about coming attractions and what is possible to know within ourselves. This gap begins to lessen as we practice. Sitting is a way of revealing our lives to ourselves. What is happening when we sit? Sometimes contentment, sometimes peace, oftentimes boredom, oftentimes restlessness, oftentimes agitation or inertia, dullness. Same thing is happening in our life. Now, it's not that the sitting reveals the sitting reveals our life to us. We can see in the sitting what is happening in the rest of our day that we don't often slow down enough to pay attention to. No, but we see it much more clearly when we sit. You could say that we do get something out of the sitting, that we actually do get something out of practice. What we get is our life. That's all. We get our life back. We've lost it. And we get it back in the practice. It's a way of embodying our real life instead of our pseudo life. Now, our pseudo-life is the life of plans and of fantasies and of aversions and of concepts. It's really allowing that which appears to seem real. So it's allowing the film of thoughts and emotions, which we think are our real life, to be seen as images that come and go. Not as solid as they initially appear to be. And some of us know, when we sit, when we first begin to practice, they're there in a very strong and vivid way. As we continue, they begin to subside. We begin to see thoughts and emotions as they are, much more clearly, as clouds that are covering up the clear skies of the mind, rather than as inherent realities. So we do find our real life. As well, sitting is a decision to stop. It's actually a decision to stop running, to stop avoiding, and to stop pretending. Krishnamurti once said that when you're in physical pain, it's sometimes a very wise idea to move, to shift, to get out of that physical pain, you know, to not stay in the conditions that are going to lead to more physical pain. He said, in the midst of psychological pain, don't move. In the midst of emotional pain, don't move. Don't turn away. And some of you who have heard Krishnamurti talks or videos can experience this as a command. Actually, it's an invitation. What is being said, I feel, is that it is possible to stay still in the midst of strong emotion, of vivid thoughts, and be able to see our way through. So it's actually a statement of confidence. To stop running, to stop avoiding, to stop pretending, to stop pursuing pleasure as an end in and of itself. Not that there's any kind of problem with pleasure itself. No, it's not a problem at all. It's the thought of repeating it. It's the thought of more tomorrow. It's the thought of trying to get it back. It's the idea that it can be accumulated so that somehow we'll have only a life of pleasure, which those of us who have tried know is not possible. Maybe we've all tried in certain ways. So it's knowing pleasure and experiencing pleasure and enjoying pleasure, not withdrawing or turning away, and at the same time recognizing its limitations, that it's impermanent, it comes and goes, and it can't bring us lasting happiness. The practice is a process of turning around and facing ourselves, facing whatever it is that's occurring. Facing past accumulation of suffering. When we sit, we experience everything that has happened, in a sense, in our life, is there for us to see. And so, in the seeing, we can be with it in a different way. Instead of being afraid or intimidated or overly drawn in or seduced by it, we can stay still in the midst of it. And we can allow it to be treated quite differently. In the practice, we are meeting our conditioning with awareness. In our life, we are meeting our conditioning with non-awareness a lot of the time. We are meeting our conditioning, certainly, whether we practice or not. But when we practice, we are actually meeting our conditioning with awareness, which is really different than perpetuating our conditioning because of non-awareness or unconsciousness. Now, it's saying that it's possible to be with conditioning in a radically different way. When we meet our conditioning with awareness, there is a way in which we can allow very gently, very lovingly, quite compassionately, for its dissolving. Now, every single time we're willing to be present in the midst of things as they are, and things as they are is just another way of saying conditioning, there is a way in which the conditioning weakens itself. There is a moment of freedom every time we stop and we're willing to open our arms and embrace that which is. Be aware of it. We also learn in this way to stop creating new sources of suffering, because we begin to see so clearly where happiness comes from, not where we've been educated to think it lies, but to know deeply for ourselves that it is within each one of us. In awareness, there is a dissolving of inner obstructions or of inner conditioning. And so bringing the light of awareness to the inner reality is a way of knowing freedom. What we are practicing, in a sense, is allowing the imprints to arise so that they can be transformed and let go of. This is just an example of this. Some of you may remember Kung Fu, and some of you may even have begun to practice Dharma because of Kung Fu. I actually know a younger person who began to practice because of reruns of Kung Fu. This is a Kung Fu excerpt. Kane, I am troubled. Master, why? Kane, my parents are long dead. General Chung is tumbled down from his arrogance and power. Yet within me, anger boils as water in a heated pot. Master, observe the day lily. Each morning with the warmth of the sun, it opens in lovely blossom. Each night it closes. Kane, I do not understand. What has a flower to do with my anger? Master, once your anger warmed you, and like the flower you opened to it, that is long past. It is night. Kane, am I then to do nothing, feel nothing, be still? Master, still water is like glass. It is the perfect level. A carpenter could use it. The heart of a wise man is tranquil and still. Thus it is the mirror of heaven and earth, a glass of everything. Be like still water. You look into it and see yourself. I don't know who the writers were for this, but it's pretty good. In observing, rather than immediately, the knee-jerk way, reacting, the imprints are let go of into spaciousness. Now, it's a natural, organic process that we become part of. You know, we take on this tradition of being seeking freedom. And in allowing for the dissolving is into spaciousness. The mind begins quite naturally to settle down. And when the mind settles down, wisdom is bound to come up. When the mind is distracted and up in the air and lost in the clouds, it's not possible to see clearly, even though that might be our deepest yearning. Even though we may want so much to see clearly, it's just not possible because we're fluttering way above the surface of things. It's not even superficial. It's way above the surface of things. And so as we allow the mind to come down into itself, into the body, what happens is that wisdom naturally comes up, because wisdom is our true nature. We make space for the unconscious to become conscious. Virginia Woolf said, "It is in our idleness that the submerged truth sometimes comes to the top." This is sacred idleness, allowing the truth that has been ignored for so long to come to the top through this practice of doing nothing. To see deeply is not a luxury, it's really a necessity. It sometimes dismays me or cracks me up to see that people watch TV a lot, and it's not seen as anything selfish. It's seen as just everybody watches TV. Now, it's not a selfish thing. And yet sometimes people relate to the practice, or even to the formal practice of sitting, as something that they don't deserve to do. One has to do this, or one has to do that, or get this done, or get that done. And it's almost perceived as selfish to sit, when watching TV is not. This is really, really an odd thing. Extremely odd. It's a cultural value, rather than waking up as a cultural value.
Someone named George MacDonald said, "Work is not always required of a person. There is such a thing as sacred idleness, the cultivation of which is now fearfully neglected."
And we see that this is true. Oftentimes we can't sit still, we can't be still, we can't allow for an inner stillness because of some strong sense of anxiety. What am I getting done? You know, we have these lists that we think we need to go through every day. And our feeling of contentment sometimes comes from how much of the list we've attained or gotten done. And then we wake up the next day, and of course, life is full of lists. You know, kind of the thing in practice is, can we have the lists and at the same time throw ourselves fully into whatever it is that we're doing instead of being enslaved by a list that we've created? No one has usually done it for us. We may feel the crowds around us, you know, telling us we need to do, we need to become, we need to attain, we need to get. But actually, it's always only ourselves, and so we can let go. We can let go of it ourselves. This is that beautiful poem by Mary Oliver, "The Summer Day." Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean, the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? And this is our Dharma question. Instead of what am I getting done, perhaps a better question would be, what is the quality of my heart right now? What is the quality of my heart right now? Not what is the quality of my life as a concept. It has been this, it will be this, I have to get there. But in the moment, always a Dharma question is only that which can be asked in the moment. It's not something that one even needs to have a verbal response to inwardly. But to over and over again in our daily life, remember to ask the question, what is the state of my heart right now? Is something else possible right now than thinking I need to get something in order to feel satisfied? Thinking I have to get rid of something in order to feel peace? Yeah. Thinking that I have to dwell in perplexity and confusion, that that's a requirement of a modern person, you know, is to be confused. But instead, what is the quality of my heart right now? You know, is it possible to know contentment in the most difficult of moments? Is it possible to know peace even with the calls around us of what seems to be required in order to live a life of happiness? What is told to us, what we've taken in ourselves, of what seems to be required in order to know deep and lasting happiness. Where deep and lasting happiness is found is only within the heart, is only within how we hold the heart. So what is the state of my heart right now? Sometimes just simply asking this question allows us to let go of the conditioning, allows us to let go of thinking we have to have, of thinking we have to get rid of, necessary to get rid of. Helps us to let go of the confusion and allows for clarity and loving kindness and compassion. Sometimes just asking this question is enough because we click into our own true knowledge. You know, not something that has been told to us, but our inner knowledge, our inner wisdom of where peace really truly comes from. Just to go back to the sitting for a moment, we can think of a whole lot that needs to be done when it's time to sit. I had a practitioner once who was very devoted to daily life practice and tried to sit every day. It was the only time, she said, that she would notice that her dining room table needed to be dusted. The rest of the time, she was fine with the dust on the dining room table. But every time she sat, she felt like she had to get up and dust it,
yeah,
instead of staying still.
Now the conditioning is very strong with us. It is a radical act to do nothing.
Yeah. And I don't mean just in the sitting. I mean in the inner life. It is a radical act to do nothing. It is really against the grain of the culture.
There are huge questions within us having to do with what real meaning is in life, with why we exist.
And sometimes we can think easily that busyness is the world's answer to this. You know, it keeps us moving. It keeps us in so much activity that we can't stop to see anything else. We can think that it validates our existence. And it's so easy to move into a compulsive activity, an extensive distraction and overstimulation in life, with some kind of thought that the more crowded our calendar is, the more successful we are. Now, it's kind of like we're in junior high school. The more popular we are if our calendar is crowded. It's a very funny thing. We have to sometimes feel that all moments are filled and accounted for to justify our existence on Earth. And we oftentimes feel afraid that we'll find a void if we stop all the activity, that we'll find that there isn't anything there, that all the books that we read and all the talks that we've heard, we'll find that there's actually nothing there. This is what each one of us has to discover for ourselves. You know, we can be reassured that yes, there is. True nature is very real. There is that which is beyond the material. But each one of us has to see this and know this for ourselves. And so it's constantly a courageous thing to stop.
You know, to inwardly stop. Oftentimes, as I said, we're lost in activity for the sake of activity or to avoid our emotions,
you know, so that we don't have to slow down and stop and notice what is actually there. If we do this long enough, it does lead to a great deal of despair because we believe that if we do things correctly, we'll find some degree of meaning, and we don't. Over and over again, we don't. And so we find ourselves more and more lost in despair. We can so easily find ourselves living for the sake of some future moment, finding ourselves lost in fantasy and in preoccupation. We can have an exaggerated sense of our responsibility in life, what our responsibility is. And we can so easily get confused between the difference of desire and need. In other words, we are in this life to love others, to know love, to respond to love, and be able to offer that love to others as well. There is a huge difference between trying to satisfy the desires of others and trying to help others that are in need. As you know, on the Buddhist path, we're trying to understand and let go of our own desires. You know, knowing that in trying to fulfill our desires, we miss the inner contentment. You know, we're just missing where contentment can be found. And yet, so often in our relationships with others, we think that we have to satisfy the desires of others rather than focus on the needs of others. And it's such a different story. You know, it's a huge relief to begin to discern between the two. and begin to be able to offer that which is really helpful and necessary and can be taken in, rather than a stopgap kind of measure that doesn't go very deep. Thomas Merton once said, "To allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit oneself to too many projects, to want to help everyone and everything, is to succumb to violence." Now, in other words, when the heart is at ease and comfortable with itself, then we know more about this terrain of being truly able to help, without it turning into that which is neither helpful to the person that we're attempting to help, as well as to ourselves. So there's a way in which we learn how to keep this in balance in the practice of sacred idleness. Doing nothing doesn't at all mean not acting or not living a really full life. It actually allows us to live a very full life. We have to act in this world. Someone once asked Krishnamurti, "Why get up in the morning?" And he said, "You have to get up. You have to get up." And of course, we have to get up. We have to act. When my sister had three children who were all very close in age, very small, she was having a hard time. And so we would talk about the hard time that she was having. And those of you who have experienced this know this very well. And those of us who haven't can imagine easily how hard it is to maintain a sense of balance in family life with three little kids and a dog. So I found a button in a store that I gave to her at one point. It was kind of a big button, and it had a cartoon picture of a woman on the button. And then, you know, kind of coming out in the bubble like a cartoon were the words. The kids were screaming, the dog was barking. I just had to burn it down. Which, you know, so oftentimes she would, I would come home and I would just play my answering machine, and I would just hear the words, "I had to burn it down," you know, and then click. That's all there was to it. She was conveying everything in that sense of "I had to burn it down." But that's the way it is. You know, life is so unpredictable. And we find ourselves confronting conditions that are not what we would have at all chosen if we had a choice. No? And so non-doing doesn't mean passivity. It means a receptivity. It doesn't at all mean not acting. It means doing what needs to be done with a full mind and with a really whole heart. It doesn't mean to not be reactive or to not do doesn't mean laziness. It means inwardly not moving in reactivity. Now, it's easier to be lazy. It's a lot of work to not move in reactivity, and yet this is our practice. Keeping the heart still is indeed its own thing. It requires enormous creativity and enormous dedication to the truth and enormous devotion. In a conventional way, not doing does imply the mind wanders, and then out of that wandering, there is simply more wandering. And this is what those of us having come to the practice know. We've come out of a life in which the mind has wandered, and then we don't know what to do, and so the mind wanders more and wanders more and wanders more, and then, of course, we have to find our way home. In practice, we're already home. Now, from moment to moment, we're not finding our way home. In a sense, we're always already home. We're just knowing that more and more. But because it's such a way of dedication to keep the heart still in the midst of conditions, in the midst of reactivity, it's so important that there be an ever-abundant source of compassion and of gentleness. It's not struggling with not moving. You know? I mean, we're talking about not doing, not moving in reactivity, but it's not engaging in struggle, which is sometimes where we find ourselves because we find it so difficult to not just react.
So it's not being engaged in struggle. It's understanding that just as birds fly, brains think.
That's the function of brains. The function of birds is to fly. The function of brains is to think. So it's not inherently any kind of a problem. No, it's to understand that it's natural. It's just that we don't have to go along with it. You know, we can be aware. We can do something that is radically different than our conditioning is pushing us towards.
We can be aware. In the midst of activity, sometimes we do need to move very, very quickly in our everyday life.
Is practice still possible? Absolutely. We can move quickly without hurrying. And that is a wonderful practice in and of itself. You know, throughout the day, to do what we need to do, to not be like we might be on retreat and think that, you know, slow walking is practice or that kind of thing. The slower we go, the better. How can we practice in the midst of life? But instead, to embrace our life exactly the way it is, to move as quickly as we might need to move in our work life and our home life, you know, but not to hurry. And to practice with this is a really, really interesting thing to do. You know, not to slow down, not to think that we have to slow down physically, to really be in the flow of life, and at the same time, let go, completely drop the compulsion to inwardly hurry, which means letting go of the striving, letting go of thinking we can be somewhere before we're there. Practicing when we're going to the store, not thinking about the store, not already imagining that we're there, but actually being in each step along the way. And then when we're in the store, not thinking about coming home, you know, really doing whatever it is that you need to do. Sometimes one goes into a store and totally forgets what one is doing because we're absorbed in what we need to do when we get home. Now, it kind of makes us more efficient, actually. It's a side benefit, but it's a nice side benefit, is efficiency. It's really valuing inner silence, and it's moving through life without an agenda, simply throwing ourselves into each activity with wholeheartedness. It is true that when we practice inner non-activity, we can do more in life. Our life does become more creative, and there is greater richness because there is an energy that is released. We find ourselves tied up in the inner torments of heart, and so it's very difficult sometimes to move in the ways that we want to or need to, that which would be more creative. And as we practice inner non-activity, we find that there is an enormous energy that is released. We have more energy available to us to do what we need to do, to move in the ways that would be more creative for us, when we're not completely preoccupied with trying to get and trying to get rid of. We can see that true strength is inwardly staying still in the midst of the torments of heart. Now, inwardly allowing for a stillness in the midst of the torments of heart. And then there is more choice in the way that we act. We're not as pushed around, you know, by what we think we have to do or need to do. There is more creativity and choice in the way we can live our lives. We can respond instead of being enslaved. And we can see that there actually is choice to respond rather than to react. In this practice of non-doing, non-inner activity, we might think that it's impossible to make decisions. You know, if we're always constantly throwing ourselves in the midst of activity, how can we make decisions that we may need to make in our life? Decisions can come out of a deep inner silence. Out of being still, we might actually make the decisions that bring greater benefit to ourselves and others. And we might actually see the choices that we may need to make and the consequences of those choices, so that our actions are more skillful. One way to practice with making decisions and allowing a stillness in the midst of the heart is to not take sides with the various voices that naturally arise when we're trying to make a decision. Any decision we're trying to make, the mind says this and then supports it with a thesis. You know? But then you can go about that for a while, and then from the other side, you know, another thought will sneak in and be very, very convincing that this is the way to go. You know? And then you can go about that for a minute, an hour, 2 days, and then eventually, you know, another thought from that other side will come in. And same thing, try to convince us that this is actually it. And so what do? You know, sometimes we just do whatever we can do and go in one direction or the other. But if there is inner stillness, then we can listen. We can actually be receptive and listen to the voices without siding with either one. And when we don't side with either one, oftentimes there is a wisdom that reveals itself, and we know what to do. If a wisdom doesn't reveal itself, at least what we can do is to get behind whatever decision we've made with wholeheartedness, without second-guessing ourselves. There's a very good short poem, "Muddy Water, Let Stand, Becomes Clear." In other words, in stillness, we can see more clearly. We can see the wanting, we can see the not wanting, we can see the confusion that is propelling us into making choices that we may find ourselves not very happy with at a certain point. A very good question is, what are we deciding out of? Are we deciding out of our hearts, or are we deciding out of a passing flash of a thought, or of a reaction, or of an emotion? And there's no real answer to that. It's the answer is to sit very quietly until we see for ourselves. I'd like to read you a poem by Lao Tzu. "The ancient masters were profound and subtle. Their wisdom was unfathomable. There is no way to describe it. All we can describe is their appearance. They were careful as someone crossing an iced-over stream, alert as a warrior in enemy territory, courteous as a guest, fluid as melting ice, shapeable as a block of wood, receptive as a valley, clear as a glass of water. Do you have the patience to wait till your mud settles and the water is clear? Can you remain unmoving till the right action arises by itself? The master doesn't seek fulfillment. Not seeking, not expecting, she is present and can welcome all things." Our essential practice in life, our essential meditative practice, is not actually to try to achieve anything at all. It's not to try to get happy. It is to let go of the obscurations that are hiding ourselves from ourselves, to let go of the clouds in front of the sky, to have the confidence that we can, and from moment to moment to soften into how things are. Not to trust the clouds, to trust the sky instead. Our practice is actually to know Buddha nature, and we find ourselves just fine whenever we touch it, whenever we don't believe the clouds. Our false identification with there being a limited sense of self, a limited self, begins to slowly fade, and we find ourselves being able to respond in an open and a spacious way. And this has actually been documented. This was from the New York Times. A scientist invited Buddhists and Franciscan nuns to meditate and to pray in a secluded room. Then, at the peak of their devotions, he injected a tracer that travels to the brain and can reveal its activity at the moment of transcendence. So listen. "A pattern has emerged from his experiments. There is a small region near the back of the brain that constantly calculates a person's spatial orientation, the sense of where one's body ends and the world begins. During intense prayer or meditation, and for reasons that remain utterly mysterious, this region becomes a quiet oasis of inactivity.
a fact that could explain the borderless spiritual communion felt by the faithful for millennia. It creates a blurring of the self-other relationship, said this scientist. If they go far enough, they have a complete dissolving of the self, a sense of union, a sense of infinite spaciousness. Already, scientists say, the young field has provided evidence that these meditative states are a natural part of the brain, that humans are, in some sense, inherently spiritual beings. I don't exactly think we needed the New York Times to tell us this, but it's very interesting. This is who we are. We are practicing this art of doing nothing and finding out for ourselves what this nothingness is. And we discover happiness is in no thing. Happiness is in no thing. It lies in awareness. It lies within the uncontrived, the uncreated, and the unconditioned. May all beings know peace within themselves. May all beings know their own Buddha nature. May all beings live in love and in compassion. Can we sit just for one moment?